Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Banks across the country are on the verge of meltdown. The government has already stepped in a big way, but there's more to come. More money, trillions of dollars devoted to bailing out banks. And like it or not, some form of nationalization, taboo word, is on the table. How far will it go? This hour on Point, Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times columnist Gretchen Morgenson on what's next for banks. You can join our conversation, what's the way out of this banking crisis? Did you ever think you'd be part owner of Bank of America? Joining me now from New York City is Gretchen Morgenson. She's a business columnist and assistant business and financial editor for the New York Times. She won a Pulitzer Prize in 2002 for her coverage of Wall Street. Gretchen Morgenson, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
So nice to have you.
Help us
understand how vulnerable some of the country's biggest banks are, banks like Bank of America and Citigroup.
Well, we are in the midst of a downturn, an economic downturn. So what began, Jane, as a mortgage crisis, where loose and lax lending practices really was at issue and too many loans made to too many people who couldn't pay them back, mm-hmm. has now morphed into a full-blown, economic downturn. So the problem is that as more and more people lose their jobs, as more and more people default on other kinds of loans that they have outstanding, such as credit card debt, car loans, etc., it's a cycle that kind of keeps going and very, very difficult to arrest it or to stop it. And so that's really kind of where we are right now, kind of in a whirlpool.
So in this whirlpool, we've already put $300 billion into these banks. Has any of this money helped the banks recover? Has it helped the situation?
Well, it's difficult to know because one of the least attractive parts of this whole program is that there's very little sort of transparency about who's getting what and why. Of course, there's always discussions about, playing favorites and fears that there might be favorites being played in this money that's been dispensed so far. But what we have not seen, Jane, is a big increase in lending. And that was, of course, what the goal was. Banks had been curtailing their lending, sort of recoiling from the market in reaction to the bad loans that keep piling up. Delinquencies keep rising. Defaults keep rising. So naturally, the bank's first reaction is to say, okay, I'm not going to make any more loans. I've got to husband my capital. And that was what they were doing, sort of hoarding almost. And so what the fear is that there really hasn't been a lot of lending, even though the taxpayers' money has gone into these banks.
Well, talk more about that, Gretchen, because it was the government's intent for the banks to lend that money. Were there any written guarantees or other assurances that that would actually happen?
There were very few strings attached to the initial bailout money, Jane, and that's really a source of, I think, a lot of irritation among people who are watching this unfold. Remember that Secretary Paulson, who was then Secretary of the Treasury, walked up to Capitol Hill with a three-page document asking for this so-called TARP money, which is Troubled Asset Relief Program. And it was very vague and unclear about what the sort of strings would be, whether there would be any kind of quid pro quo or at least an attempt to hold banks' feet to the fire, to make this money actually go out into the market, which is what everyone agrees needs to be done. So there was very little in that initial program sort of written into the requirements.
You talked about very little transparency during this process. I mean, why not? And for the most part, what has happened to that money, that $300 billion?
Well, it's gone to major banks and, lesser-known banks. It, I think, is obviously there are lists of banks that have received it, but it's unclear sort of how they were chosen. You know, we know that some of the largest banks were chosen because they presumably have the ability to help drive, a recovery of sorts. You know, it's easier to have a Bank of America or a Citigroup contribute to greater lending out there in the world than, say, you know, two or three or five mom and pop banks. But, that's the hypothesis anyway. And so we do have now an oversight committee that is determined to kind of watch the TARP program and make sure that they understand what's going on and write monthly reports about it. So I think that's a positive. We'll get more information as they continue to do their work.
The Obama administration, Gretchen Morgenson, is now looking at nationalizing the banks. Explain to us, how would that work?
Well, nationalization is sort of a last resort. I mean, the banking system is necessary because, as we all know, lending is what greases the wheels of commerce. We need loans to be made to small businesses, to large companies that employ many, many people. We need loans to be made to people who want to buy a home, who are maybe transferred in their company, need to sell their existing home in New York and move to Washington. You know, there are just so many, banking affects so much of the economy. It's just central to any recovery, any economic recovery that we might see here. So, but we really talk about nationalization is very, very difficult because you don't want the government to be running the banking system. It really is best as a private sector enterprise because you just don't want politicization of lending to take place. The closest thing that we had to that was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, of course, which were the government-sponsored enterprises that were charged with helping borrowers get mortgages. And, you know, we saw what happened when a quasi-government agency was involved in that process. You know, we had to take them over and at enormous losses. Mm. So nationalization is a frightening thing to many people because it's perceived as not the right answer. Now, it could just be a temporary answer, of course, you know, that for the moment, until we have a maybe do a good bank, bad bank type of an arrangement, which we did during the savings and loan crisis of the early 90s, and that worked quite well. But the idea of flat out nationalizing the banks, you know, into perpetuity, I think is nobody's idea of where we should go.
Well, and at the same time, it seems to me there is an internal debate within the administration and among leaders in Congress, as I have been reading, about whether nationalization or partial nationalization is a good idea. Here's Nancy Pelosi speaking on ABC's This Week, talking about whether nationalization of banks is a good idea.
If we are going to put money into the banks, we certainly want equity for the American people. In other words, if we're strengthening them, then the American people should get some of the upside of that strengthening. Some people call that nationalization. I'm not talking about total ownership, but we're just saying now how big that investment becomes would we have ever thought we would see the day, would we even be using that terminology, nationalization of the banks?
Gretchen Morgenson, describe what that might mean. I mean, would these be private-public partnerships like Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac? I mean, would the government be fully in charge?
Well, I think that what you have to have is a sort of a public and private partnership, i.e., if the government is going to put taxpayer money into these banks, then they should be forced to raise private capital as well. Mm. Okay? We cannot do it alone. It just would require the government to print too much money. And so, therefore, there is money on the sidelines. You know, I think that a lot of investors who do have cash that they've kept on hand for a rainy day, which we are now in, would be willing to deploy that money if they had a clear view of what the government was going to do. I mean, part of the problem, Jane, has been this kind of back and forth and up and down and maneuvering and changing of minds that has taken place that has characterized this whole process. You know, first they were going to buy troubled assets. Then they decided they were not going to buy troubled assets and they were going to just put capital into the banks. There really has been sort of no sense of a an overarching plan that, you know, is being followed. And so, therefore, private investors are remaining on the sidelines because they're saying, wait a minute, I don't know what the government's going to do next.
So I think if
we have a plan in place that people can believe in, that might start to help.
So who would be in charge then, Gretchen? Would the government run it in such a case, or would there be private partnerships of sorts?
Well, I think that there has to be an entity that is government, run, i.e. the Resolution Trust Corporation, which in the early 90s took care of the bad assets that were the result of the savings and loan crisis. Now, what that did was that was a full-blown operation that took these assets off the bank's balance sheets and then sold them piecemeal as they could to private investors. And therefore, what happened with that was that the banks were left healthier because the bad assets were off their balance sheets. Hmm. They could then start lending again. Their capital position was stronger because the bad assets had, migrated over to the government's entity. I think that kind of an idea, that kind of a structure can work here.
Just before our first break, Gretchen, do you think that the case for nationalization is stronger now of the banking system than it was just a few months ago?
Well, I think that the case for having a battle plan that is fully public, that can be scrutinized, that whose operation can be watched over, that is certainly, I think, something everyone can agree on. I just don't think that nationalization, I think it has too many negative consequences, particularly if you don't have an end in sight. You need to have an exit strategy if you're going to be talking about nationalization.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're speaking this hour about banks on the verge of collapse. Gretchen Morgenson is a Pulitzer Prize-winning business and financial columnist for The New York Times. She is our guest this hour. Gretchen, I wish you'd start this segment by explaining to us Sweden's experiment with nationalizing the banking system. Many people in this country may not know about what they did and how it worked for them. Will you tell us about it?
Well, the Sweden situation was one in which they had made similar bad loans at the banks, and the government had to come in and rescue them and, take over the entire process. But I think, again, you mentioned it at the outset here, it was the transparency, I think, that's different in our situation. Plus, our situation is just far, far larger in terms of dollars. And so it is a good example of how it can be done and how it can work, but we are talking about so much more money that it just becomes difficult to see how we're going to get there.
Sweden also set up a so-called bad bank.
Yes.
And tell us why that was important and why the economy there quickly recovered upon doing so.
Again, it's similar to the SNL crisis and the solution there, and that is that you get rid of the toxic loans from the bank's balance sheets. You see, what's happening is that as these loans default or go delinquent or go bad, they have a sort of feedback effect, often because banks borrowed very heavily to buy them or to make the loans. They borrowed against them on their balance sheets, and so that amplifies the losses that the banks have. So if you can get those off your balance sheet, then the bank's capital position immediately improves. And if you give the bank more money and have private sector, capital allocations to the bank as well, then it can begin the lending process all over again. It's just that you have to get rid of those assets.
But who would want them? And when do they become sellable?
Well, part of the problem that we have, Jane, is that people feel that they can't value the assets very easily. A lot of these loans are piled into securitization pools. These are, big chunks of loans that are pieced and pooled together and then sold out in slices to investors. And so a lot of people feel they can't value them, but it's not really true. I mean, it can be done. It just will be laborious. So first order of importance is to step in and value the assets. Get a level at which you can say, okay, this is worth roughly X. And then you'll have private capital start to come in and say, okay, I think that's a good value. I'll buy that asset because I think maybe the selling has been overdone. I think maybe the defaults that are expected in the future are not going to be as large as you think. You know, this is what makes a market, differences of opinion. And so I believe that once you get a value that's reasonable, that's been really assessed by an independent third party, you know, who doesn't have an axe to grind in this, then you start to have a conversation with people with private capital to say, I'll buy that, I won't buy that, and then you'll get the wheels moving again.
How long would taxpayers, if the U.S. steps into a nationalization sort of structure, how long would taxpayers be the owners of these banks?
Well, that's, of course, a what shall we call $64 trillion question. I mean, nobody knows the answer. And so that's a part of this transparency problem that we have. What is the exit strategy? We do not have an exit strategy, and that's contributing to uncertainty about why private capital would want to step in here. They don't know how long the government's going to be involved, so they don't want to step in and find out that any capital they put into it is then wiped out by a further move by the government. So you need to have a plan. You need to have an exit strategy. You have to have someone say, okay, we'll be out of here by thus and such date, and or, you know, we want X return, and this is what we're aiming for with our investments. There has been none of that.
What about Gretchen Morgenson increasing, say, the size of the stimulus package to get money to people in a different way, to actually be able to pay back their mortgages, to go about this in a different manner?
The problem with a stimulus package, Jane, is that it is feared, and rightly so, I believe, that it would simply go to pay down debt. The Americans have taken on so much debt in the last, you know, decades. It's been a spend more than you earn kind of a mentality. Mm-hmm. And so the problem is that if you send someone a check for $1,000 or $500 or $200, it might just go to paying down your credit card bill. Now, that is an intelligent thing to do because you've got a, you know, usurious interest rate on your credit card. You've got a huge, you know, it's exponentially growing because of the high credit interest rate. And so it makes sense to pay it down. However, a stimulus package is supposed to try to get people spending so that people buy goods, so that people stay employed. So the problem is if they pay down their bills, then you're not going to get that kind of a boost.
Let's invite some of our listeners into this conversation with Gretchen Morgenson, business columnist for The New York Times. Richard is first up on the line. He's calling from Southold, New York. Richard, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I wanted to call in because the topic that you're talking about is something that is directly relevant to me, and I think I'm a pretty good example of one of the problems that's going on with the rescue program. Mm. I am a person, and with trying to not sound too immodest, but I think I'm a poster child for an SBA loan. Are you familiar with the SBA loan?
SBA loan. Tell us.
Small Business Administration, the SBA stands behind the federal program. It's they stand behind loans that commercial banks make to individuals so that if individuals don't pay them back, the federal government provides some of the payment back to the bank.
Sure, okay.
The purpose of SBA loans is for small businesses, and SBA stands for Small Business Administration, is for small businesses to get capital to build businesses and to create jobs.
So how much did you apply for your loan?
A whopping $75,000.
Hmm.
Now, here's the interesting part. You know, I am someone who started two businesses in the past. One of the businesses I started here on Long Island, I started in 1995, and when I left in 2000, I had employed over 200 people. And I have two master's degrees from Columbia University. I have a net worth in seven figures. Unfortunately, it's not very liquid. And the irony of ironies is that Citibank actually had 2 years ago given me a $75,000 loan. In these programs, you have 2 years that they sort of are credit lines, and then they turn into a term loan.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm doing this new business, the last thing I needed was to start paying off a loan. I really needed the credit. So they took my credit away in December, and my banking person, and I've used Citibank for 8 years, said, let's just apply for a new loan. We'll pay off the balance on this, and then you'll have your credit line back. And they turned me down. So and here I am. I'm trying to start a business in healthcare technology. I mean, I can't imagine that if I can't get a $75,000 loan, which Citibank had on its books back in November of 2008 already, if they won't replenish that, I don't know who can get an SBA loan. And someone like myself who wants to help to hire people and create jobs in this country, if we can't get credit, this economy is going nowhere.
Richard, thank you. Gretchen Morgenson, here's Richard trying to start a business, creating jobs, a good example of how banks are just not cooperating, not playing along.
It certainly sounds like it. And Richard, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for your situation. And I think that you can multiply Richard's situation probably by millions across the country. You know, this is precisely what is happening and precisely what the taxpayer really does not want to have happen to all that money that they've poured into these banks. Now, a banker would say, well, you know, we are trying to cut down on loans that are not repaid. I mean, I'm sure that Richard is credit worthy, but, you know, their arguments always are, well, you know, bad lending got us into this mess, and so we have to be extra careful now. And that is a natural response to, you know, a lending binge, which we certainly had during the early part of this century. But, you know, in the meantime, the goal of the program was to get lending going, and it does not appear to be working.
It does not appear. Banks are not lending. I mean, what have the taxpayers received in the midst of all this? $300 billion into these banks so far. You know, we now own 6% of Bank of America, 7.8% of Citigroup. And what does that mean for us as taxpayers?
Well, it means I'm fearful of a possible inflation down the road because, you know, the dollar will be worth less because of this kind of printing press that we have here with, you know, money being thrown at these banks. I mean, it is a necessary evil to, you know, try to get these banks to lend again and to print money to do so. But there will be consequences for years to come of this whole program. So the idea that the banks are not lending is really something that has to be addressed by our leadership. And, you know, the sooner the better.
The rapid deterioration of these banks, Bank of America, Citigroup, among others, required all of this money on top of the $300 billion that we've already poured into these banks. How much more do you think it's going to take? How much more money, taxpayer money, do you think will be poured into these institutions?
Well, there is another, $400 billion that has been requested. The initial TARP program was $700 billion, I think. And so, you know, they've already requested that. That's already been approved. So you can pretty much consider that to be a done deal. But, you know, I think that when we are said and done that the losses that the banks will incur and the necessary capital that they'll need to shore up their financial position will be in the trillions of dollars.
I've read 1 to 2 trillion. You say more. I mean, this is 5-10% of our gross domestic product.
Yes, it's very dispiriting. However, if you want to have a silver lining to the cloud, at least it's not as bad as it is in Europe, for instance. There, the losses are a far greater percentage of GDP.
Here's another call now. Gretchen Morgenson from Michael in Beaufort, North Carolina. Michael, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I don't have easy answers, but I do. But I think it's important to get some facts, I think, correctly. Your guest mentioned that government the onus nationalization is a bad idea. Look at Ginnie Mae, Fannie Mae. Well, let's remember that Ginnie Mae, Fannie Mae got in trouble when they followed Wall Street in those practices that Wall Street was initiating, and Ginnie Mae, Fannie Mae saw all the action drift towards that, and so they followed that herd. That was their mistake, following the private banks. I have an MBA. I believe in free market in the long term, but the market is really broken right now, and I just read something about the bankers. Even whilst we're in the middle of this trouble, John Thane at Merrill Lynch was worrying about renovating his office and his bonuses. So we have a problem that priorities on Wall Street right now have been misaligned for years, and maybe a temporary period where they are set to become the priorities of fixing what's wrong and then return to Wall Street may not be a bad idea. But I think saying that nationalization, that we might have some bad people at the helm, might be false if you consider what's happened for the last 5 years.
Michael, thank you. Gretchen Morgenson, you hear our caller Michael talking about priorities on Wall Street. Might it be time for a change? Can there be change, really?
Well, he certainly is right and spot on about the misaligned incentives and the really egregious behavior of the CEOs on Wall Street and at some of the commercial banks, the big ones. He is dead right about that. You know, the question is, with the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac situation, yes, they were reaching for market share to compete with Wall Street. But again, it displays that the problem with the quasi-government aspect of Fannie Mae, it does display the potential politicization that goes on when the government is in the mix over the long period. You know, if you want to talk about so-called nationalization, I do think you have to have a finite time frame. And I think Michael was also saying that same thing. But wow, if someone could finally teach these people on Wall Street a little humility, it's amazing to me that even now, with all of these losses and firms that have failed and government intervention and taxpayer money at stake, that we still have situations where, like Mr. Thane, yes, was apparently asking for a $10 million bonus at the end of last year.
And snuck in $4 billion in bonuses before the year end as the bank was hemorrhaging money. I mean, he's been fired, but this stuff is still going on. When is this kind of business going to stop?
I don't really know. It is a complete mystery to me. I mean, it suggests a total tone-deaf, boy in the bubble kind of mentality that I just do not understand. I understand that leaders become sort of isolated, that CEOs can become isolated. They are surrounded by people who are yes men and yes women. I understand that. But gosh, how about having a spine? How about having a moral compass inside of you? If you're a leader, you should lead. You shouldn't try to take everything that you can get. I mean, it is appalling, the leadership, quote-unquote, that we've seen at some of these companies.
Let's squeeze in a quick call here before our next break. Mark is in Toronto, Canada. Mark, welcome to On Point. I just have a short time before the break. Can you be quick?
Yeah. Hi. Great topic.
Thank you.
I just want to say that it looks like the whole notion of moral hazard here is not being addressed, because the taxpayers seem to me to be being fleeced by these banks, and I don't see how pouring billions into this black hole will get us out of this mess. But I'd like to ask your guest if she thinks once you nationalize the banks, they could possibly reprivatize at a profit for some of these casino-like managers who are CEOs.
Mark, thank you. Gretchen Morgenson?
Well, I certainly think we could. That's, again, the part of the task that I think is crucial, which is the finite aspect of nationalization. If we put these bad assets into an entity, then try to sell them, there is a chance for profit for the taxpayer there. So that's my hope.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about banks across the nation teetering on the brink of failure and what can be done to save them. We're joined this hour by Gretchen Morgenson, Pulitzer Prize-winning business and financial columnist for The New York Times. And we have a line of callers. Let's get right to them. Nancy first in Acton, Massachusetts. Nancy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
It's great to be on the show. My question concerns the shareholders, because I'm a shareholder.
Yes.
And too often we're looked upon as the bad guys, and I'm a shareholder because for 25 years I contributed to my 401k and bought a diversity of stocks, which I thought were going to be safe, and now I find that I hold a number of bank stocks and I'm in a lot of fear that as this crisis unfolds, you know, we're going to lose all of our value. And I just wondered, you know, so my concern is that the shareholders are not always bad guys as well. I mean, we're people who thought we were making good investments and now find ourselves in a very difficult situation.
Nancy, thank you for the call. Gretchen Morgenson, what do you say to someone like Nancy? She's been contributing all these years, thought she was making good decisions, and here she is, stuck.
Shareholders are by no means the bad guys in this circumstance. They're the victims of what I would consider to be mismanagement and egregious behavior by the people who were leading the banks. When you have loans being made to people who could not repay them, and when you had circumstances which led to this problem, which was that there was a complete sort of obviation of responsibility. If you were a bank and you made a loan to someone that may not be able to repay it, you didn't really care because you were going to sell that loan to someone else. You were going to package it, pool it, put it into a securitization trust and sell it to, you know, an institution somewhere, maybe Norway or France or Japan. And so this sort of due diligence, the sort of know your customer element of banking just went out the window. It was all about generating fees. And for a while, that generated enormous profits for these institutions. But now we've seen tremendous losses, and the shareholders are absolutely being decimated. Now, the CEOs, all they do is maybe lose their jobs. And, you know, it just shows how unaligned the management is with the people who own the company, who are the shareholders. Mm. It's a disgrace. And I have total sympathy for shareholders and anyone who has even an index fund, an S&P 500 index fund in their 401k is a bank shareholder because banks were a big part of the S&P 500 index. So, you know, this idea that we were all supposed to manage our own retirement accounts meant that we went into the stock market, and that's a great way to make money in many, you know, decades. But here we have a situation where we are all being punished by some bad behavior and reckless lending practices of people at the top of these organizations.
So those are the people at the top. Let's talk about the people who may be at the bottom of all this. With all those billions of dollars pumped into the banks now, Gretchen Morgenson, how has this helped us address the crisis that the average homeowner is in at this very moment?
Well, very little has been done for the troubled homeowner at this point. And this is something that I think that is going to change under the new administration. It's very complicated, but we really have seen a concerted effort to throw money at the institutions that sort of got us into this mess. And that's a really unfortunate thing. But it has to be done because banks are central to the economic growth of this country. So, but the homeowner, you know, the troubled homeowner, the homeowners who maybe have lost their jobs and therefore can't pay the mortgage. I mean, we're not going to talk and have much sympathy for the people who were just speculating, who were buying houses to flip them to a greater fool, as it were, if the price went up. We're talking about real people who perhaps were victimized by an unscrupulous mortgage broker who lured them into a loan that had a rate that would change, that would go up dramatically in a couple of years. Perhaps they were, made to pay enormous fees, which actually added to the size of their loan. There are a lot of folks out there who really didn't understand what they were getting into. And, as far as taking responsibility, yes, they must take some responsibility. But I think that we are going to shift now towards more attention paid and perhaps money being devoted to helping troubled homeowners.
I've just been handed a story that's just across the wire. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, in his first full day on the job, is announcing new rules to limit special interest influence on the government's $700 billion financial rescue programs. New rules that are designed to crack down on lobbyists' influence over that rescue money. The new rules will restrict the contact that officials can have with lobbyists in connection with application for funds for that bailout money. Gretchen Morgenson, a step in the right direction?
Certainly sounds like it. We have lobbyists who have special access to lawmakers. I don't know about you, but I don't have special access to lawmakers, and I think that getting rid of that part of the equation is definitely a step in the right direction. You know, the banks are now partly owned by you and me and your listeners, and it is absolutely wrong for people to be allowed to get to the head of the line and make their special pleadings to lawmakers on behalf of the banks that got us into this mess.
Let's get another listener into this conversation now from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam is on the line. Hi, Sam. Welcome to On Point with Gretchen Morgenson.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Gretchen.
Sure.
Your voice in the New York Times is a clear voice. I always look forward to an antidote to what generally is going on. And my request is this: I don't think we make enough distinction between investment and speculation, and really making a clear distinction between making a bet and investing in a company, and also the difference between making money and delivering goods and services, because they're really completely different. They have very, very little to do with each other. And what I see is that, you know, bad people have always done bad things, and lending money to gamblers, banks lending money to gamblers, is a bad idea. That's what happened in 1929. I think that's what's happened now, and I don't want my tax dollars supporting or bailing out gamblers. I mean, these people would bet on the apocalypse if they could make money. They don't care if the world comes to an end, just as long as they make money. And I wish you could just speak to the fundamental difference between gambling, which is speculation, and investment, because I don't think they have very much to do with each other, because gamblers don't care who wins or who loses.
Sam, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Gretchen Morgenson?
I couldn't agree with you more, Sam. I mean, I think that part of the problem that we saw in this mortgage meltdown, which is now a credit crisis, is that managements that were running these financial institutions, which were supposed to be prudent in their lending practices, really sort of gave up that whole idea and became gamblers themselves. I mean, what you saw at some of these major banks was an amassing of leverage or debt that was just eye-popping. I mean, in the old days, they had limits on the amount of borrowings that they could make on their assets. And they just went wild with them, sometimes 30-to-1, 40-to-1 leverage. And what that means is that if the assets underlying that borrowing decline at all, you're really in trouble, and all of a sudden you're in a death spiral. So yes, I agree wholeheartedly. There has been a focus on immediate gratification, which is the quarterly earnings number that everyone has to make. There is not as much long-term sort of growth acceptance, you know, that don't think about tomorrow, think about 5 years from now, you know, 1 year from now. It really has become a sort of instant gratification game, you know, a la Las Vegas. Mm. And I think that really has to be rethought.
What about Gretchen Morgenson, when courts alter these mortgages and now force banks to accept the new terms of the deal, these so-called cram downs? Are they going to be more prevalent now as we move forward?
Well, there is legislation out there to force the bankruptcy judges, or to allow, I should say, bankruptcy judges to intervene in some of these cases and to reduce the size of the mortgage, for example. And that is something that I think is gaining momentum, and it's not an easy answer, unfortunately, because while it does get rid of the immediate problem of a borrower who maybe has a loan that is far larger than the value of the house underlying it, when you alter a contract that a borrower took out with a bank, you know, so that the number is now smaller, I mean, that kind of goes right to the heart of contractual obligations that we sign. And, you know, that's a very tricky thing. You know, it's potentially troubling. I mean, I believe that the banks should be made to step up and agree to these things, you know, as a part of an acceptance of taxpayer money. You know, I mean, I think that that's part of what we must try to do. We must try to have an idea of the taxpayer, you know, being a beneficiary here, or the homeowner being a beneficiary here, since for all of those years, these institutions were the beneficiaries of their reckless lending practices.
Well, how can that happen, Gretchen, if everything's secure these days?
Yeah, it's really difficult. You know, the securitization really made everything far more complicated. Now you have to have everybody who is in the pool agree to a loan modification. This is why the modification process has been so slow in coming. It's very hard to get, you know, 1,000 people into the room and say, okay, do we all agree that you want to modify Gretchen's loan because
right.
she's delinquent. You know, it's a an enormously complicated matter. It can be done, I think, but the government has to force it, I believe. You know, that's kind of one of those things that really only the government can do, because it's just too difficult. I mean, you know, it's something that I think the lenders are having trouble doing, or they have an obligation to try to keep people paying. That's their motivation, and so you have to have a government sort of mandate to go and try to modify loans in a mass way.
Here's another call from Vermont, Burlington, Vermont. Arnie is on the line now. Arnie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
I have a question. My son has a small business, 13 people, successful. And like most businesses, he's got a revolving line of credit. He had $27,000 to Bank America, and he paid it off just because he had the cash.
Yeah.
And the next day, Bank America canceled the line, the revolver. So here's my question. Rather than give good money to banks that have failed, why don't we use that good money to start new banks to continue to fund successful businesses?
Hmm. Arnie, thanks. Gretchen Morgenson?
I think new banks are being set up to fund new businesses. They don't have the legacy bad assets on their balance sheets, and so they can be, you know, more willing to lend to a business like your son's. I don't think that we are at the point in time where the government is going to start to fund those things, but I do think that if we take the bad assets off the balance sheets of the banks in some way, coordinated way, where the government can then analyze the value, put a price on it, see if there's any private capital that's interested in buying it. That process could help get Bank of America and other banks lending again. But again, we're not close to that. There is talk about it, but again, it's not something that's going to happen tomorrow.
Here's another call. Anne is on the line now from Malden, Massachusetts. Hi, Anne. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I think it's a good show, but you're doing damage to my blood pressure because I am just crazed by all of this. I'm like the woman from Acton that, you know, I'm 56. I was hoping to retire at 60.
Yeah.
I had a net worth of $300,000 and I've lost $100,000.
Yeah.
So I would have been much happier to take a lower rate of return, you know, if this wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I'm a nurse practitioner. I work with the homeless, so social justice is big. And for these people, if I did my job like that, people would die. I'd be sued for malpractice. I think we should have a class action suit against these Wall Street people and sue them. Maybe they could give some of their bonuses back. It's just, I was raised by Depression-era people. I pay $100. If my Visa bill is $100, I pay $1,000 if it's $1,000 every month. I owe nothing. I have like a $790 credit rating. So that I should be penalized, it just...
I hear your frustration, Anne. I hear your anger. That is a sentiment that a lot of people are feeling these days, Gretchen Morgenson. What do you do about this moving forward? What about new regulation put into place so things like this don't happen again?
Well, I would say that Anne has a wonderful idea, clawing back executive compensation that was received for earnings that actually weren't earned. Because if you go back in time and you say, let's tote up all the losses, for instance, at Merrill Lynch, you know, that undoes a lot of years of earnings, right? If you net that out, then you say to yourself, gee, CEO, Mr. Whoever it was, ought not to have earned that money. Let's get that back. Now, unfortunately, it's a drop in the bucket as far as, you know, when we're talking of trillions of dollars. But it, I think, would send a message to executives elsewhere that this can be done, that if your performance is later shown to be bad for, you know, the economy, certainly the shareholders, egregiously bad in this case, that the money is, we're going to try to get that back from you because you actually didn't earn it. I don't see anything wrong with that practice.
This idea, Gretchen Morgenson, in our final minute here of a nationalized banking system. We're talking in the office this morning. Andrew Jackson will be rolling in his grave at this kind of a talk. Is there something un-American about this idea, about this possibility?
Well, I think there's something, I would say, un-American about a set of practices that benefited a few at the expense of many. And that's what I call un-American. And we've got to get out of the mindset the notion that I can grab mine right now and I don't care what the consequences are for the rest of the world. That is not American, and I really want that to be, you know, gotten rid of in this country. And that, unfortunately, was the mentality during the mortgage boom that now we are paying for in spades.
Gretchen Morgenson has been our guest this hour, business columnist for The New York Times, assistant business and financial editor at The New York Times, won a Pulitzer Prize in 2002 for her Wall Street coverage. Your reporting has been a light to many people during this time. Gretchen Morgenson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure to hear from you. You can continue our conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Huang, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsanis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.